By 1948, Raytheon had captured 95% of the world's hearing aid vacuum tube market. Bell Labs announced the development of the point contact transistor in July of that year. To protect this profitable hearing aid market, we brought out the CK703 point contact transistor. It was unsatisfactory for hearing aid use because of high noise and the inability to withstand normal mechanical shock found in hearing aids. For example, if we used a point contact transistor and were able to get it with the low noise we required, if you dropped the hearing aid, the transistor stopped functioning or became very noisy. Also, the gain wasn't quite high enough on the point contact transistors, and mechanical sensitivity and the high noise were principally the main problems. In July of 51, Bell Labs announced the junction transistor. In the first half of 1952, I arranged to visit GE through the contacts we had at Raytheon with the top echelon of GE, and I visited RCA also as an RCA. We were a licensee of RCA and receiving tubes, and that led into semiconductors. I found that both companies were using the alloy process to make a few alloy junction transistors a day. And we had sent a few people to C.G. Smith and George Friedman to Bell Labs that spring to see how they made their junction transistors. We then kicked the ideas around, and I made a decision then that the alloy process looked like it would lend itself to high-volume production pretty quickly, whereas the grown junction process looked like it was very troublesome to scale that up to high-volume production. So on that basis, we decided to go ahead with the alloy process. We got the know-how from both GE and RCA. The man at RCA was Dr. Charlie Mueller. Well, anyway, we made the decision to go with the alloy process because it would lend itself to immediate high-volume production, whereas the grown junction process would take a long time and be very difficult. To the best of my knowledge, the grown junction process was discontinued sometime later, and the alloy production process ran for many more years. I guess it was used up to the late 1950s into the early 60s. We made our first good junction transistors by mid-52. By August, September of 52, we were making quite a few experimental transistors a day, and then we reached high-volume production by October of 1952. I was able to throw a lot of people into that production line, a lot of engineers, foremen, direct labor people, because we drew those out of the receiving and special tube divisions where we were employing a couple of thousand people at the time. We released junction transistors simultaneously to about 12 hearing aid manufacturers. That was 95% of the group. In January, we released these simultaneously in October of 52 to these 12 hearing aid manufacturers. In January of 53, at which time we had 10,000 transistors in stock, we believed that before we announced availability, we had to have thousands of transistors in stock because the demand was intense. And so we decided to pile them up before we began to ship them to these 12 companies. The Bell Labs president called me in a phone call sometime in early 53 that they had under 300 transistors in stock at the time, indicating some problems with Bell Labs production processes. We used the alloy junction technology for transistor production, and Bell was using the grown junction process. This latter process was very labor-intensive with a very low production yield. When the president of Bell Labs called me, he asked me if he could borrow a few hundred transistors. That was in the winter of 1953. He told me that he had 500 transistor engineers at Bell Labs working on transistor circuits for the telephone industry, and only 300 good transistors. So each engineer was just allowed a few hours a day with each transistor, and he had many engineers sitting around because they didn't have enough junction transistors. Well, we loaned him, instead of the 300 he wanted, we gave him 500 or 1,000, told him he could keep them for 2 or 3 months, and he was flabbergasted. I believe his name was Mr. M.J. Kelly. I'm not sure of that. Now, in 1955, we announced the availability of a comprehensive 116-page publication entitled Transistor Applications, More Than 50 Practical Circuits Using Raytheon CK722 Transistors. This booklet is a collection of over 50 CK722 circuits, which had been published since 1953 in either Radio Electronics Magazine or Radio and Television News Magazine and a few other popular publications. In addition to these excellent articles, the booklets contain tentative data sheets on early Raytheon transistors, including the CK722. There are many historic construction projects reproduced in this classic booklet. According to an internal Raytheon memo reviewed at corporate archives, as of September 14, 1956, approximately 118,000 copies of this booklet had been sold up to that time. Now, there were many articles that ran in magazines that had circulations. I don't know what the circulation was of radio electronics or radio and TV news, and there were several other magazines that carried Popular Mechanics and so forth. So the chances are that a couple hundred thousand copies of either our booklet or articles in these magazines were published. It built up the demand for the CK722 so that although we don't have any exact numbers, as of about 1957, we figure that maybe 150, maybe it could be as high as 200,000 of these were sold throughout the country and many to foreign countries. Some of the emails in this booklet that is coming out in the CK722 shows you the intensity of the interest on the part of young people in the CK722. At the time, in germanium transistors, the germanium transistor would operate on very small battery voltage. The actual drop in a germanium diode, which is part of the transistor, was only about 3 to 4 tenths of a volt. Incidentally, in silicon transistors, that drop is up at about 7 tenths or 8 tenths of a volt. So the germanium was an ideal thing for crystal diode radio receivers and audio oscillators and so on.